We have a quorum. I'd like to call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And I think the first order of business would be the approval of our minutes from our February 9th meeting. Representative Detmer moves the minutes from February the 9th. Any corrections, discussion? Hearing none, the minutes, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, and the minutes are approved. Before we start officially, I'd like to just welcome a group here that's here from Brown College. If they want to stand up and just be recognized, they're visiting here to see what we're up to. Thank you for coming. There's some Rasmussen folks here as well. Okay. Glad you're here. Who else? At Minnesota School of Business?
Are
they here? Oh, great. Wow. Oh, there's lots. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Detmer.
You know, anybody bring any chocolate? Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
That was in public safety.
Yes, public safety. Gentlemen, yes, make sure you know what you're supposed to do. So.
And we have some presidents here, too, which probably will be introduced by the chancellor. So, again, welcome to everybody. And today we're going to hear from Chancellor Steve Rosenstone. And good to see you here for your second visit, I believe. And we look forward to your presentation.
Well, Chair Nornis, members of the committee, it is indeed a great pleasure to be here. I mark, I think, to the day, 6.5 months on the job. How time flies. I really would like to use today as an occasion both to give you, if you will, my assessment, but more importantly, to engage in discussion about the direction that we're going, the hard choices we're making, and what we're committed to providing for the good people of Minnesota. I'm joined today by four presidents. These are four presidents who've been elected by their peers to serve on the Executive Committee of the Leadership Council. And with your permission, Chair Nornis, a little later in the conversation, I'll be inviting them to offer a couple remarks to make a little more vivid some of the work that our colleges and universities are doing. Those presidents are President Richard Davenport from Minnesota State University, Mankato, President Kevin Kapischke from Alexandria Technical and Community College, President Larry Lundblatt from Central Lakes College, both in Brainerd and Staples, and President Edna Smetansky from Minnesota State University, Moorhead.
Chancellor, maybe they would stand so we could all see who they are. There we go. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm also joined today with two members from our Board of Trustees, the Chair of the Board, Scott Thiss, and Brett Anderson, a member of the Board as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me offer just a very quick overview of the ground that I would like to cover. One, I want to give you very quickly, an overview of what I've learned over the last year and 2 weeks since the board appointed me, 6.5 months since I began on the post. Secondly, to alert you to, I think, some of the challenges that we face, not just the challenges that Minsky faces, but the challenges that Minnesota faces. Third, I want to talk about the strategy that we're using to try to meet the challenges. And then finally, I want to get a little more detail about the specific actions and steps we're taking to implement our strategic direction. With your permission, Chair Nornis, I would welcome this being a conversation, and welcome under your direction colleagues interrupting and engaging in conversations at a point that seems most appropriate. I'm sure it's a huge disappointment, but I have not prepared 2 hours of comments for today, and hope that the comments will guide the conversation and that this will be a shared exercise today. If there's a broader context that I'd like to think we keep in mind through today's conversation, is that it's not just about Minsky. It's about how we put the pieces together. And the pieces, in my mind, are the sectors of higher education, the sectors of our communities and workforce and business needs, and the sector of K-12. And part of what we are trying to do in Minsky is figure out how we can work more closely with each of those sectors to put the pieces together to produce more powerful outcomes for the state of Minnesota. So what have I learned? Much of it has come from listening to students, faculty, and staff, to businesses and community leaders, and to legislators. In my visits around the state, I've learned about the remarkable role and contributions that Minnesota State colleges and universities make and the resource they are for the entire state. 3 points that came out of my 6,000 miles on the road, three takeaways. First, our colleges and universities provide tremendous access to higher education across a really vast state. Having spent most of my years, 15 years in Minnesota here in the Twin Cities, you don't realize how big 80,000 square miles are and how, if we're serving Minnesota, we need to do it in a way that's thoughtful and respectful about that geographic space. I've learned firsthand what a deep and broad impact we have, not just on the students we serve, but on the businesses across the state and on the communities that we serve. We're an essential part of the vitality of some 47 communities across Minnesota. And I learned firsthand how crucial we are to preparing Minnesota's workforce, to ensuring that the people that leave our colleges and universities are prepared for the work that needs to be done in nonprofits, the work that needs to be done in leading our communities, the work that needs to be done in leading businesses and industry across the state. I learned firsthand about the vast number of students we serve, 420,000 students. We are the fifth largest system of colleges and universities in the nation. Our open admissions policy means that any student that has a high school diploma or has completed a GED degree may enroll. And we are committed to serving all Minnesotans, not just a few. We pride ourselves in the number of students we serve, not in the number of students we turn away. We pride ourselves in the quality of our graduates, not just in the ACT scores of our freshmen. When we think of PSEO in the state, 82% of all the PSEO students enrolled in the state of Minnesota are taking those PSEO courses in one of our colleges and universities. When you think of our students, it's not just the student fresh out of high school. It's workers that come to us to be retooled for new professions. It's workers that want to update their skills. It's adult learners with an average student in our system of 26 years old. We serve more low-income students than all the other systems combined. We serve more students of color than all the other systems combined. And if you look at the total profile of our students, 70% of our students are either first generation from families with very modest incomes or students of color. We are committed to ensuring access to that education going forward. And if you look just at the undergraduates in the state of Minnesota, 60% of all the undergraduate students are enrolled in our colleges and universities, with all the other undergraduates spread across the other three sectors, if you will, of education. In short, we educate Minnesota. Our students are Minnesotan, our graduates get jobs in their chosen field, and our graduates stay in Minnesota. We prepare Minnesota by conferring more than 40,000 degrees, certificates, and diplomas each year, and we train Minnesota by providing the workforce that is the engine that drives Minnesota's prosperity. Now, in addition to the certificates and degree programs that we have at our colleges and universities, we also are in deep partnership with 6,000 businesses across the state through our customized training programs, which create hand-tailored programs to meet the needs of those businesses to ensure that roughly 120,000 employees every year get the up-to-date technical skills they need to keep that business and industry competitive. That's in addition to our certificate and degree programs. The other thing I learned is that there's been a huge growth in our enrollments, roughly a 15% growth over the last decade, and that we're continuing to manage our resources prudently to increase productivity and reduce operating costs. So if you look over a 10-year period at the cost of delivering a Minsky education per student we are serving, correcting for inflation, the actual cost of delivering that education is now 10% lower than it was a decade ago. Now, who's paying the cost has changed. So as state support has declined, more of that responsibility has ended up on our students. But the actual cost of delivering that education in constant dollars is not higher, it's actually lower. The system office is substantially smaller. Over the last 4 years, the system office is 24% smaller as measured by its base budget, not in constant dollars, just nominal dollars. And as a percentage of the total systems itself, not just the system office, but as a percent of the total system itself, the red line on your chart, the share of the total resources going to run the system office has dropped substantially. And compared to other systems of higher education in the country, we are the 37th in rank in the amount of overhead associated in the system office with serving the students in that system. That's one of those lists where you want to be near the bottom, not near the top. We're 37 out of 50. Faculty productivity over the years has gone up substantially, about a 12-point jump over the decade. And we've dramatically expanded our online offerings over this time period, 152% increase over the last 5 years. And in addition to over 100,000 students taking online courses, we also have an additional 49,000 students who are taking so-called blended courses, which put together both the face-to-face component and an online component. So what does all this add up to? Not only have we gained in productivity and efficiency, designed to protect affordability and improve quality, but we are the most cost-effective, most affordable higher education alternative available in the state of Minnesota. So if you compare our tuition to that of the private trade schools are roughly 219% higher in their tuition than the comparable Minsky institution. Compared to the University of Minnesota, they're roughly 77% higher in tuition than a university in the Minsky system. And compared to private colleges and universities, the not-for-profits, their tuition's roughly 360% higher than it is in the Minsky system at our universities. So I've not only learned a lot about Minsky, I've learned an awful lot as well about some of the challenges facing our state. And whether you're in out on the range or down in southeast Minnesota in large communities or small communities, I'm hearing the same set of concerns from the people of Minnesota. Many people are concerned about finding a job, and many businesses are concerned about finding people with the skills necessary to fill those jobs. There's a lot of concern, particularly in greater Minnesota, about the vitality, the economic vitality of those communities. And needless to say, there's a lot of concern about access and affordability when it comes to higher education. Let me just be a little more specific about some of those points. I've talked to a lot of people in manufacturing, a lot of people in healthcare, a lot of people in biotech, and the painful reality is this. We have about 167,000 people who are unemployed right now in Minnesota, and we have lots of manufacturing firms, lots of biotech firms, lots of people in the health sectors that simply can't find qualified workers to fill the 167,000 positions which are also open. One state leader put it this way. He said, changes in the workforce needs coming forward are coming on like a freight train. We're going to very quickly go from high unemployment to asking, where are the workers? Now, this workforce of the future is also going to dramatically change, and it's been changing extremely rapidly over the last decade, and it's going to continue to change going forward. Our colleges and universities must deliver graduates that are prepared for the work of the future, and it's not just a set of technical skills. It's much broader and deeper than that, because our graduates are probably going to have 4 or 5 different careers over the course of their lifetime. It's not just about the skills necessary to begin the first job. It's also about the depth of knowledge and breadth of knowledge they have to retool themselves, to learn, to be creative, to be innovative, and to take on the jobs that we can't even imagine sitting in this room today. And I think if you imagine the jobs that exist today that are the hot sectors in Minnesota's economy, many of them did not exist a decade ago. And we need to be prepared for graduates to take the jobs that we cannot even imagine today, but will need to be filled a decade from now. The simple fact of the matter is the governor's Workforce Development Council has shared with us Minnesota's going to face a workforce shortage going forward if we don't do something about making sure we have the educated workforce we need for the future. If you take a look at all the states in the nation, we are number three on the list of the need for an educated workforce to meet the needs of business and industry here in Minnesota. 70% of this workforce in 2018 is going to have some post-secondary education. 83% of all the new jobs being created between today and 2018 are going to require some post-secondary education, with about half of them requiring baccalaureate degrees and half of those jobs requiring some certificate or two-year degree from one of our colleges. Now, the problem is that if you look at the pipeline, we're not preparing students for this kind of education, let alone this kind of work. As you well know, one quarter of the students that begin as freshmen in high school do not finish on time. If you look at communities of color, one half of the students that begin high school do not finish on time. We have the third largest achievement gap in the country. So the fastest growing populations in Minnesota are those least prepared for higher education. And we are entering an era that if you do not have some post-secondary education, there will not be good paying jobs out there for you. You will be condemned to a life of poverty. And it's not only the whammy of not having the workforce we need, it's the double whammy of what that's going to do to the social services we're going to have to provide as a state to sustain those sectors of our population. We're working very hard through the P20 Council, which Representative Poppy serves on with me, to try to drive across all sectors of education a closing of this achievement gap, an absolutely essential problem for Minnesota to solve. The next chart I want to share with you is not a Minsky chart. It's a chart about the state of Minnesota. And what this chart looks at is the change in the total state support of higher education in Minnesota, the red line, compared to the total support for higher education in the states across the nation, the blue line, correcting for the number of students that each of us are serving. And what this chart shows is that over this time period, Minnesota has moved from being an above average state in its investment in higher education to a state that is no longer even at average. We're actually below average in our support of higher education. The cuts to higher education have dropped 40% in Minnesota. They've dropped 19% in the nation as a whole. So at precisely the time when we need to have a better prepared workforce than ever before, the state has disinvested in higher education. And if you look at the last 2 years, which are not included in this chart, and ask how well have we done as a state in protecting higher education, there are 41 states in the nation over the last 2 years that did a better job protecting higher education from cuts than Minnesota did. That's not a recipe for having the prepared workforce of the future. How does this translate for Minsky? The next chart goes out another couple years beyond the chart from before. It's just Minsky, not the state as a whole. And this chart shows that over this time period, there's been a 45% cut in real dollars in the amount of state support available per student we're serving in Minnesota State colleges and universities. These cuts have occurred despite the increased productivity in our faculty and staff. They've occurred despite the wage freezes that our faculty and staff have taken on multiple times over this time period. They've occurred despite the administrative cuts, despite the more efficient use of our space, despite the lower cost in real dollars of the education we're providing. And needless to say, some of the cuts that have occurred in state support have resulted in what we're all familiar with, and that's the increase in tuition, the increase of the share of the cost of education being borne by our students. We have long ago abandoned the covenant that existed with our students and with our state, that the state would cover two-thirds of the costs and our students would cover one-third of the costs. We are getting preciously close to threatening even a covenant of the state of Minnesota covering one-third of the costs. This is a threat to Minnesota's future, because at the precise the time we need to ensure access to higher education, we've raised the hurdle that our students have to jump in order to take part in higher education in our colleges or universities. And it's at precisely the time when students that have traditionally not availed themselves of higher education need to be brought into the system. Minnesota cannot afford to leave any sector of our population behind. We need every single worker prepared for the work of the future. This is a disaster waiting to happen, and together we have to find some ways to solve it. So that ends the first part. What I've learned, and I think some of the challenges that I think we collectively face as a state: the pressing need for a better educated workforce, the pipeline that may be leaving too many behind that threatens our ability to produce the workforce we need, and the huge public disinvestment that's occurred in higher education at precisely the time we need a better prepared workforce. So about 6.5 months ago, as I started the job, I obviously met with a lot of reporters. And the first question I was inevitably asked in each of these interviews was, are you nuts? Why would you take this on with what you have learned and the challenges that both Minsky and the state of Minnesota face? I don't have any regrets at all for taking on these challenges. I am excited about the direction we're going and excited about how together I think we can meet these challenges. So I want to share with you the strategy we're taking, and I want to get into a little detail about some of the specifics. And I'm going to also be asking at various points in the next couple of minutes for our presidents to join and give some examples of the work they're doing. We developed the strategic framework. And by we, I mean the presidents and I work to develop a framework describing how we're going to move forward. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities play an absolutely essential role in growing Minnesota's economy and opening the doors of educational opportunity to all Minnesotans. So we have made three very powerful commitments. And these are the commitments embodied in the framework. Commitment number one: we will ensure access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans. We want to remain the place of hope and opportunity that serves all Minnesotans that want to pursue their education, and we want to be the destination of choice. We are committed to providing the best available education in Minnesota, preparing students for work, for life, and for citizenship. And we want to be held accountable for the quality of the education by looking at the quality of our graduates and their competencies, not the ACT scores of the freshmen. Second, we're committed to being the partner of choice, to meeting both community and workforce needs. That means several things. It means digging in and solving the real-world problems that are facing our communities and that are facing businesses. And it also means making sure that we're preparing the graduates that are needed to meet the needs of business and industry going forward, and that we prepare graduates that are better prepared than ever before. And the last commitment is that we deliver to students, to families, to communities, to businesses, and to taxpayers the most affordable, highest value option available in the state of Minnesota. And we do that by doing two very simple things: boosting quality and reducing costs. And we are hell-bent on making good on each of these commitments. So I don't want to give you the whole work plan, everything we're doing, but there's a work plan, there's benchmarks, there's deadlines. The presidents are leading every aspect of the implementation of the framework. We are moving forward quickly. We devised this plan in the first 60 days. The implementation plan, after consultation with faculty, students, and staff, was up and running in 120 days. The board unanimously adopted this framework at the January meeting, and we have very aggressive timelines for moving forward on our projects. So I just want to give you a flavor for what some of the projects are, but really not get into detail on all of these, but would be happy to respond to questions as they arrive. Under the first commitment, ensure access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans, there's a set of projects around access, and there's a set of projects around extraordinary education. Now, as you well know, in many of our programs around the state, we're already, our faculty are already providing an extraordinary education. And where those programs are extraordinary, we want them to become preeminent. And where the programs are pretty good, we want them to be extraordinary. And I'm very grateful to the faculty across the state who will be leading discussions about how to do this, where we can make things better, where we need to showcase the practices that are the most effective ones, and how we can tell that story substantially better. It means increasing collaboration. It means looking at how technology can help us do an even better job. It means thoughtful measures that document what students have learned when they graduate from our programs. Under the second commitment, there's a lot of work that has to be done here, but the most important, one of the centerpieces of this, is a set of conversations that will unfold this spring, where we're working collaboratively with DEED, with the workforce centers, with the Governor's Workforce Council, with the initiative foundations, we hope with the chamber. There will be a sector-by-sector, region-by-region set of conversations where we go out and listen to what the workforce needs of businesses and industries across the state are. DEED is preparing the data, but we need to have a much deeper understanding, not just of what the needs are today, but what that's going to look like over the next 3 to 5 years. What are the new industries that are growing up in Minnesota, and what do we need to do to align our academic programs to meet the needs going forward? And to use this well-overworked Minnesota expression, we need to skate to where the puck's going to be. We need to know a couple years in advance of where we need to be so we can get these programs aligned and make sure that we're delivering the kind of workforce that Minnesota needs and that we're delivering the kind of education that our students are hoping to get when they come to us. And under the last commitment, there's a very, very aggressive set of projects designed at further reductions in costs. And one of the centerpieces of this initiative is the Shared Service Co-op. This is a co-op being directed by the presidents, not the system office, which says, rather than everybody doing their own payroll, rather than everybody doing their own purchasing, rather than everybody doing their own HR, rather than every single campus doing their own processing of student loans, let's pool the best people in the system and do it at a lower cost, far more effectively, with better service to our students and better service to the faculty that are providing our programs. This is, yes, sir.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I do need to stop for a question here.
Please, if you can do that.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chancellor Rosenstone. Going back to the last slide on partner of choice and meeting workforce community needs and actions, the last bullet, you also mentioned the achievement gap that we have here in Minnesota. How can we get the secondary education and the K-12 together to work on that achievement gap and preparing these students that for secondary education?
Chair Nornes, Representative Detmer, a terrific question. And let me share with you, beyond the work of the P-20 Council, the conversations that Director Pogemiller and Commissioner Casilius have been engaged in. There are several parts of this puzzle. One part of the puzzle is high school graduation standard can't be here and college readiness here. We need the two aligned. And quite frankly, we cannot have as many students arriving to begin post-secondary education with the level of preparation they're having. They need to be better prepared. And one step in getting better preparation is make sure we're all agreeing on the same standard, point one. Point two, we need to understand earlier on whether students are on track to be post-secondary or college ready. That assessment has to be early, starting in around eighth grade, and each year we assess. And it's for several reasons. One, so we give feedback to the students and parents. Second, we give feedback to the teachers in the schools. And third, when that student is college ready, we want to find a way in which he or she can begin college when they're ready, not just when the clock says 12th grade is over. And so we're also looking for more concurrent enrollment opportunities, more post-secondary education opportunities. The third part of the puzzle, and that will make huge efficiency for students, huge efficiencies for the state, move people who are ready through the pipeline faster and sooner and earlier. But the kicker here is they have to be students that are ready to take that next step. Then the third part of what we're looking at is that this is more than just an academic assessment. it's not just a matter of whether you can read and write and have spatial reasoning skills and the like. There's another dimension of this, and that's what kind of post-secondary education. Not everybody ought to go off and get a bachelor's degree in philosophy or a bachelor's degree in political science, though we need a lot of political scientists, I think. We need some people who are also going to do other kinds of work, and indeed there are some students for whom that's their passion, that's their interest, that's their skills. And so we're also looking to assess in 10th or 11th grade what the right next path is for a student. A student may be interested in technical education, but does a student get made aware of what those alternatives are and have a tool that lets them assess whether that's the right path for them? So we want to do several things. Faster, better, more alignment between the two systems, more feedback to K-12, more college readiness, get people on the right path and get them on the right path sooner if possible. Those are the discussions we're having. That's a pretty big set of ideas for how we can get the sectors to work together. And we look forward later in the spring to being able to share more broadly some of those ideas. And if this is something that gets legs and makes sense, there'll be lots of conversation, we hope, in the next session around the architecture.
Representative Dittmer.
Thank you, Chair and Chancellor. Is this something that can be worked out between the higher education and K-12, or as you maybe just mentioned, is something that has to be brought to the legislature to make happen, or what are your thoughts on that? How do we make it happen?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, Representative Dittmer, the first thing is to lay out in much more detail than I was able today the precise architecture. Second is, if that's what we want to accomplish and that's the architecture for accomplishing it, can we do it within existing legislation or are we going to have to make some changes? We're not quite to that step of the process. But be clear, we're trying to think very big and bold about how these sectors work together to better serve students and better serve the state and to leave fewer students behind. We know that we need to be part of that conversation and are excited about being part of that conversation. We're not going to be bashful if we need a new legislative architecture of suggesting what that architecture might be to get the job done. But we're being pretty big think about how it is we could rethink this whole system of K-12 and higher education to produce better results for students and better results for Minnesota.
The Representative Dittmer, do you have a question?
Yes, I just wanted...
I'm sorry.
Oh, is that...
Did
I interrupt somebody?
No.
Good. You just called me Representative Dittmer, so that's that's okay. Depke.
You don't even look alike.
Sounds the same.
Sorry.
I think, Chair Nornes, this is not something I'm going to get involved in.
Chair Rosenstone, or do I call you President? It's Chair.
Chancellor. Stephen works fine as well.
Okay. Your presentation is wonderful in many ways. I'd love to get deeper into the weeds and the numbers, but on your work on the P20 is music to my ears. We, in this committee, about a year ago, we had President Brunix come and talk to us, and he mentioned that the Minsky system as well as the University of Minnesota was working together with the K-12 people to pull this together. I will tell you that K-12 is willing, ready, and wants to do that. And I just wanted, I don't know much about the P20 committee, but I would assume that you're working heavily with the administrators in the K-12 area because they really want to do this, at least, you know, the people that I work with, and I commend you for recognizing this. And you recognize, we were at the One Minnesota Conference, and I thought your talk was outstanding because you get it. You get what we need in the business sector, you get what we need to do to start moving these kids, and you also understand how important it is to keep an eye on not loading our kids up with debt. So I think it's great, and I thank you for your comments on that.
Thank you, Representative Defke.
That's all.
Okay. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. I just want to follow up on Representative Dittmer's thoughts. And Representative Dittmer, I agree with you. One concern I've mentioned in this committee on the House floor, Chancellor, is about the reduction in high school counselors as being a concern, and I'm going to tie it to one of your slides, which is about faculty productivity. One concern I have is in the middle school and high school range that students may not always have access to the counseling they need, especially if they're first generation or underrepresented students, to know to be prepared to avoid the remedial situation you're discussing. So I would hope as part of your discussions, and I hope this committee would talk more with the K-12 committee and vice versa, about how K-12 cuts can directly affect the mission and the costs that occur at the higher ed level. I'm wondering about that faculty productivity slide in conjunction with this, Chancellor. As I look at this, faculty productivity is up 12.4%. Representative Banyan, I congratulate you.
It's single-handedly, I assume.
And I'm trying to understand what that number represents. The surface response would be classes got bigger. But I don't know that that's what that means, and it's a very odd line. It's slide number 14 for folks who may be looking for it. So I was wondering what's going on with the faculty productivity slide, and if classes are getting bigger, Representative Benny, I'm not pointing at you, it may be you have less time to work with an individual student who now might be remedial. You know, it might be that it's something that you might be able to get by with a student in a smaller class, but if classes get bigger, there's only so many hours in a day. So I'm trying to understand the faculty productivity side and whether you see a tension between larger classes, less advising time, and how some students can slip through and become or be identified as remedial.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, Representative Moreno, very good question. A class size is something that's a contractual relationship with the faculty, so we just can't sit there and wave the magic wand and say, suddenly we're going to add 10 more students to the class. And as you well know, in many of our technical education programs, there's a fixed number of booths to teach welding in. You just can't add 10 more students to that class, and there's a whole set of safety requirements that need to be met to keep the facility safer for our students. And there's the questions you suggest of the effectiveness of the experience if you don't have the right student-faculty ratio. Largely what's driving those numbers is the way we've, if you will, managed the curriculum. So as part of the cutting that occurred over this time period is many courses that had very low enrollments and had many empty seats have been eliminated. Many programs that were underperforming have been eliminated. And so more faculty are teaching courses with the seats all filled than the empty seats that existed. So it's not that we've just thrown students in larger and larger classes. We have managed the curriculum in a way that the classes are now filled. That clearly has an implication for the questions you've raised about the work that our faculty are doing and, if you will, the intimacy of that student-faculty relationship that exists if the class is indeed filled to the cap. But we have not just said, throw 100 more kids in the class, all will be fine. No, that's not the approach.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, and I think I should try to provide an answer, my answer for Representative Morrow, but first, if you could give me 30 seconds of geekery. Chancellor Rosenstone, does this measure rise if a faculty member teaches an extra course, an overload of some kind, or is this corrected for that?
It's corrected for the faculty effort that's being put into it.
All right. Thank you. I should ask that because thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because one reason that could happen because of overloads. I was the department chair for pretty much all of that slide until I got the foolish idea to come here, I can tell you that you went through a period where we really did have to tighten things up. And you did try to move students. So some of that increase in productivity is the student that likes having that course between 10 and 2 is now having to take an 8 a.m. class or a 3 or 4 p.m. class. We're making better use of the facility we have rather than having a lot of empty space for 12, 14, 16 hours a day. We're actually using those classrooms on a Friday afternoon when typically many students want to be gone, but we're actually working at that time. So I think some of that happened early on, and then as resources stabilize, and I think there's actually a point where we actually get a little bit more in Minsku, we might have gone back to sort of our older habits and again responding to student demand, and students want to take courses at particular times. And they don't like taking courses on Saturdays. They don't like taking courses at 8 a.m. I've tried to fill those classes for many years, and it's not easy to do. But at some point, if you offer few enough sections, that's, in fact, what happens. You actually get them going to the 8 a.m. class because they don't have a choice. So that is, I think, part of what's driving this productivity. It's not online. It's not the online stuff. Online actually probably takes more of our faculty rather than less because it requires more one-on-one time. But we have some bigger classes, and I think some of the limits on this are, in fact, our inability to find classrooms big enough to hold the classes we'd like to serve. I don't have many classrooms. No longer chair. I'd still talk in the first person. We don't have enough classrooms to serve as a 50 or 55 student section if we wanted one. It simply would be impossible. We don't have the facility that allows us to do that. So that's part of that discussion there. It's driven not just by faculty working harder or students taking classes at different times. It's also driven by the types of facilities we build in which we teach our students.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Banyan. If I could then ask Chancellor Rosenstock, excuse me. So I'm looking at this slide, and then I'd like to go to slide 22, if we might. So if I compare 14, and I see that the productivity seems to go up and then go down to about 2005 to 2009 or 10, and then I look at the state funding, which stabilizes over that same period. Is there a relationship between the state support and what's going on, whether it's with class size or elimination of programs?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, Representative Morrow, absolutely. So let's just take the last year and a half to make very vivid what the relationship is between state support and the availability of programs. As you know, $60 million was cut from the Minsky budget going into this fiscal year. That's a 9.9% cut. There are additional costs that move from year to year. They're from inflation and health benefits, compensation, keeping the lights and water running, taking care of our buildings, and the like. On average, that's about $90 million on a $2 billion budget. So there's a $150 million problem to solve going forward. 60 that you contributed to collectively, and 90 that's there from just the system meeting inflationary costs, not new investment, just meeting inflationary costs. So how do we solve that? Well, we asked our students to cover of the $150 million, roughly one-fifth, with a tuition increase, which averaged across all of our institutions, of 4%, some higher, some lower. That generated $28.7 million. The remaining $121.3 million was cut. That means people laid off. It means cutting back on hours certain facilities are available to our students. It means 81 programs being closed. It means closing the classes that we just discussed. It means reducing administrative overhead. It means not investing in new equipment, sticking with the old equipment even past its usable lifetime. It doesn't mean having the most modern equipment in the technology program at a community college or technical college. It means teaching on the equipment that might be a year or two out of date now. Those are all the choices that need to be made to meet those kinds of cuts. So is there a consequence? Absolutely, and our presidents will be up in just a moment, and we might just invite them to talk about some of the consequences on their campuses.
All right, I guess we can resume until there are more questions.
General Arnes, thank you. With your permission, I'd like to invite President Smithensky to come forward and talk a bit about work on her campus, and with your permission, would simply invite her to invite her other colleagues in series to come forward and contribute to the conversation as well.
Okay. President Szymanski, thank you for being here today, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Edna Mora Szymanski, President, Minnesota State University, Moorhead. Thank you, Chair Nornes, members of the committee. It's my great pleasure to be here today, and this is a new day for our system. I need to tell you that this is not just the Chancellor's framework or the system framework. We as presidents participated in its development, its refinement, and we own it. We've been empowered like never before, and held responsible too, to work together to make this framework work. So let me give you just two examples from my campus. We're working together now in this regional alliance, starting primarily in the northwest region of the state. We know that we need to increase degree attainment because we have industries that have jobs and no people. So the community and technical colleges and two of the state universities are working together throughout the region to provide collaborative advising, to provide cohort programs where needed, and to help connect both current community and technical college students and students who have stopped out in the region with alternatives to pursue degrees that will help them to stay in the region and contribute to the vitality of the region. That's one thing we're doing together. Another is we've talked about some of the collaboration. My institution is actually purchasing human resource services from Southwest Minnesota State. And we're providing security services for M-State in Moorhead. So there's a lot of that going back and forth that didn't occur before. And it's not that it's been mandated. We've been invited to and empowered to and held responsible to work together to help the state in ways that never happened before. So it's a new day, and I thank you, Chair Nornes, and members of the committee for allowing us to be here.
Thank you very much.
With that, if I might call forward President Kupiecki.
Before you do, any questions of President Szymanski? I guess you can invite
President Kupiecki
from Alexandria.
Mr. Chair, many members, Kevin Kupiecki, President of Alexandria Technical and Community College. Thank you for the opportunity to have a little visit here about this dynamic marketplace that is exploding in front of us between higher education, the workforce, K-12, the things that Chancellor Rosenstone just identified. Three things I'd like to bring to the table in my brief remarks. First of all, you need to know that MNSCU is the solution to this problem. We're not the problem. And one of the things that we're working very, very hard on is positioning our institutions as a nerve center of economic vitality throughout the state of Minnesota. We're doing that through our talented faculty and staff and the types of things and the connections that they have, and we continue to build with our advisory committees, with our regional economic development commissions and workforce centers around the state, through the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, with our McKnight-funded regional initiative foundations throughout rural Minnesota. And we're working, as the Chancellor mentioned as well, with DEED to look at a workforce assessment throughout the state to make sure that we're matching the types of training programs that we have available with the types of needs that are out there in that area. We indeed are at the table convening those conversations throughout the state. Secondly, these conversations are indeed driving solutions to the types of things that we put on the table today. At Alexandria Technical and Community College, we partner with regional international packaging machine companies to train some of the best-equipped mechatronics technicians in the world. We work with Douglas Scientific and Alexandria Extrusion and Agard Corporation to make sure that as we position these trained technicians, they're able to do those next-generation skills that these industries are expecting at Dakota County Technical College. We're partnering with the University of Minnesota and regional, nationwide, nationally known companies like 3M, Boston Scientific, and Hyzotron, which is not one of those large companies, but they're one of the industry leaders in the nanotech, nanoscience area that's focusing on the kinds of things that tend to get smaller and smaller in the science of nanotechnology. Northland Community and Technical College, working with DigiKey, employer of about 2,600 people in Thief River Falls, making parts, manufacturing, machining parts. And they're also dealing with the unmanned aerial systems that the U.S. government is heavily involved with that you've seen in the news so recently. And across the state, we're addressing the shortages of welders and nurses and machine tool technicians and many, many other occupations that are going to fuel this economy. Thirdly, as we continue to address the critical workforce situation, you need to know that technical education is not inexpensive. In our college, for instance, it was not unusual 10 years ago to invest between $700,000 and $800,000 a year on equipment to drive those mechatronics programs and nursing programs, welding programs, and machine tool technology programs, and train students at that level of technology they're expected to come out of school with. Today, This year, we have a $60,000 emergency fund that we have available in our equipment fund. That's all we have. We've moved from $800,000 a year to $60,000. And I think as we consider the other programs across the state of Minnesota, those are very, very critical needs. We need funding. These are not inexpensive programs. So as we continue to lead these workforce solutions, we thank you for your continued understanding and your support for the business of technical education. And I would stand for any questions, Mr. Chair, if there are any.
Okay, thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about the preferred partnership as far as what is the business community bringing to the table? You talked about everything that from the Minsky side that's being done to help provide the supply of employees, but as you mentioned, going down so greatly in the amount of money available for the equipment, is business coming to the table and providing some of that?
President Kapish.
Mr. Norris, Representative Poppy. Great question. They are bringing a lot. In fact, we just returned from a trip to Germany 3 weeks ago where we connected with, and we've been connecting with some international partners in the mechatronics area to bring next generation technology from Europe to our community to feed our manufacturing programs, our incumbent workers, and the workers being trained in our programs today. They've invested probably $3.5 million in the last 5 years into that program. The same can be said with our truck driving program, our welding program. Our faculty members are the champions here because they work to make sure that their connections with business and industry bring the level of support that we need from business and industry. Now, what we have to remember is that they're doing their share. They absolutely are. And we can check across the state and bring you information on that. We need to make sure that we're doing our share.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. You have a very dynamic school. I don't know what other word to put it, but it's admired and envied by a lot of other folks.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's because of the people who work there, and they're passionate about what they do.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to introduce Dr. Larry Lundblad, president of Central Lakes College.
President Lundblad, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Nornis, members of the committee. It's great to be here to share with you a little bit. In response to Representative Detmer's question of the Chancellor touched on several of the points that I was going to make in terms of pathways from secondary to post-secondary education. And, of course, these pathways are critical to ensure access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans, to prepare the high school students that are graduating and moving on to higher education to be productive citizens. And as was discussed, this is really a joint something between secondary system and post-secondary. And it's exciting to hear that conversations are occurring with the Commissioner of Education to open doors and to really focus on how we can better serve students. College readiness, extremely important, in addition to the content areas and things that we were talking about earlier. Focus on career and personal goals are extremely important to this process as well. So by starting earlier in the high school student's career in the junior high and freshman years and so forth, this would be a good opportunity for the students to start focusing on the direction that they want to go and start preparing for that. Representative Morrow is right on in terms of the counseling issue at the high school side, but I think that also extends to the post-secondary side as well, where we need to do a better job of helping students to move forward and to sharpen their goals and to get the advising and counseling that they need. We have plenty of systems or a number of systems in place, PSEO, concurrent enrollment. We have advanced standing for career and technical areas. So we do have strategies that are available and we're using, and as the Chancellor indicated, 82% of the students in the state taking PSEO are taking it through the MinSCU system. However, we really need to be deliberate, intentional, and systemic in terms of the change to make things happen. Now, we've got some exciting examples of what can happen across, or that are happening across the state, with a focus on the middle majority, and these are folks, the students at the top end take advantage of PSEO. They have often career goals in mind, family support. We have the students at the other end of the spectrum that need to have some special needs, and they're being addressed in various ways. But it's that middle majority that often lack focus and really aren't sure where they're going to go, and as a result, sometimes their academic performance is less than it should be because they're not sure how a math course or an English course is going to fit into their overall career goals. And so it's very important that we focus on that middle majority as well and think of strategies that we can to ensure that all high school students have an opportunity to move forward. Some of the things that are happening around the state in the Northeast, the Applied Learning Institute, 26 high schools working with the Northeast Education Higher Ed District colleges. They've created pathways focusing on career and technical areas, and I think 4,500 students since this started 5 years ago have been served. The Anoka STEP program, Anoka Technical College, the Anoka Ramsey School District, again, pathways, especially in the career and technical areas that system that's working. The early college program that was recently launched with Anoka Ramsey Community College in Irondale really is a comprehensive approach. And in central Minnesota, Central Lakes College has worked with business and industry, the school districts in the area, 23 high school districts, and the Brainerd Lakes Chamber of Commerce to create the Bridges Career Academies and Workplace Connection. A unique feature of this is the Chamber of Commerce does all the workplace connection activity preparation for the students. And last year we had over 1,700 students that were involved in that project. Extending opportunities, of course, takes resource, and it takes time and money to get the high school faculty and the college faculties together to articulate curriculum. It takes resource to develop systems, to align systems, and it takes resource for the career planning and career counseling as well. It's money well spent. It's good investment because, as we all know, remediation costs. It costs a student who takes an extra year deciding where he or she wants to go and what he or she wants to do. And so if we can provide these supports early, help the students to focus while they're in high school, it certainly would make the pathways and career transitions a lot more smoother for many students. Quite often, the closing of programs, the reduction of faculty and staff grabs a headline. But there are quite often things that we can and we know that we should be doing that we don't do because we don't have the resource. So it's important that we focus, we develop a system, and then we fund it. I'll stand for questions.
I don't see any questions, so thank you very much,
okay,
President Lundgren.
I'd like to introduce Richard Davenport, President of Minnesota State College, Mankato.
President Davenport, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself
Thank
for the
you.
Record.
I'm Richard Davenport, president at Minnesota State University, and happy to be here today. I'd like to talk briefly. This is one of the key legs of the three-legged stool that Chancellor Rosenstone talked about in regards to the strategic directions that the Minnesota State College University system is taking. And one of those is to be the partner of choice, and what that means. That's what I'm going to talk about. And to be the partner of choice requires collaboration. And I believe that all the presidents, two-year, four-year, technical colleges, universities, understand that's an imperative, that if we're going to prepare students to enter the job market, the workforce, and be successful, we have to do things differently in higher education. And we have to prepare our students better than we have in the past. And I think the ways in which we do that is to provide them some real-world experience. And we do that by internships, which have been around for a long time, but also by providing them opportunities to do consulting, research, and various kinds of activities working with the business and the public community. And you see on the overhead above me just a few examples of the kinds of applied learning that goes along with the classroom learning that really is going to enable our graduates to be more successful when they graduate. The first program, the Iron Range Engineering Program, the Iron Range Program is unique in that it is a program that was designed not strictly by the faculty in a curriculum committee, which is the typical way in which curriculums are designed, But it was designed in partnership with the faculty in engineering and the mining engineers and the owners of the mines, and trying to understand what is it that the mines need by way of engineering. They don't need simply electrical engineers or mechanical engineers. They need engineers that can work and understand all those components. So we were able to design that program, and I understand we have now our second class of students that are engaged in learning project-based engineering. You don't get that in the classroom and on a campus. Lots of other kinds of partnerships, certainly our ongoing partnerships that all the universities have with two-year colleges, take many, many different forms, as well as working with Project Maverick as another example. Probably doesn't mean anything to you, but we're working with Thomson Reuters, an IT firm. And we started a project with them, very similar in terms of context to the mining engineering. We sat down with this firm and said, what do you need? And they said, this is what we want from your graduates. And so we developed a program. We created a business, actually, at the university that the students run and manage. And we place interns working for Thomson Reuters, doing consulting and testing of software, and 100% of those students have graduated have been hired by that company. It has spread throughout many, many other states, as a matter of fact. I want to just say that our partnerships cut across K-12. We work closely with the Bush Foundation in trying to address teacher education reform. We're working in the area of private business. Faribault Woolen Mill is another good example. We work with the Timberwolves, believe it or not, and also with the Vikings. Even though the Vikings have been on our campus for 46 years, they still have needs, and we try to provide them in different ways as good partners. And a lot of students work for those organizations. We work in the healthcare area as well with hospitals and clinics. We provide opportunities for dental hygienists, opportunities for speech and hearing disorders, students that work in clinics, that work in hearing clinics and speech clinics as well. We work in the area of electronics. We work in just about every area that you can imagine. St. Paul Public Schools, schools all around the state, and the list goes on and on and on. In fact, I put a list together here of about 30, but I'm not going to go through all of those. But I wanted you to know it's different. It's different today, and I think higher education understands that. The two-year colleges, the four-year colleges, no, we have to do a better job of preparing the workforce for the future. That's the third, and I think perhaps one of the most important parts of Chancellor Rosenstone's strategic plan, to be the partner of choice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Davenport. Questions? Representative Rukavina.
Well, not so much a question, but just a comment and a thank you to President Davenport, particularly on the Iron Range Engineering Program, because it took creativity and collaboration to do it. And, of course, the first cohort graduated just recently. And out of the 14 young people that graduated, 10 of them got jobs, and they just weren't with the mining industry. One got a job in at Procter & Gamble, I believe in Cleveland or wherever it is. Another one was Medtronics, but they also worked with our timber industry, Minnesota Power. It's been a very creative program, and I want to thank you for that. But what other creative things can we do where you can get a mechanical engineering degree, Chancellor, through Mankato on the Iron Range? Are we doing other programs? Is that another way to spread our dollars that are not enough dollars, by the way, farther?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornis, Representative Rukavina, the short answer is yes. We've asked the presidents to start thinking about regional academic plans where the universities and colleges are working together to figure out how best to deliver education in the region. Here in the metro, I've asked all the metro presidents and all the state university presidents to work together on a far more aggressive metro plan. This is the fastest growing area of our state. It's the most diverse area of our state. It's the largest area of our state, and we are not serving students adequately in baccalaureate education. I'm not going to come forward and propose a new university. But I am going to come forward and propose.
I am, though. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I am going to come forward and propose that we put the pieces together in a far more powerful fashion to serve students, for example, in the metro area, as on the range. And it's the kind of collaborations that President Davenport has suggested that are the model for the kinds of collaborations we ought to grow going forward. But, Chair Nornis, I do want to express an extreme disappointment both in President Davenport and in Representative Rukavina for missing the opportunity to mention that in a statewide competition here in Minnesota that gets held every year,
yes,
statewide competition, the team of students that won the statewide competition in engineering were students from the Range Engineering Program. I would have expected Representative Rukavina or President Davenport to have brought that to your attention, and extremely disappointed that it was I who had it.
Mr. Chair, if he had usurped my, you know, my the floor here, I was going to get to that because I wanted to tell the story about these, and what they did is they transformed, I think, the carburetor, whatever runs the one of those little generators to burn any kind of fuel we can make. So the still, oh, I don't have a still, but if I had a still at home, I could maybe make a fuel if everything goes to hell here in this world, yeah, that could actually run that little generator, and they're going to maybe do something with that someday. But if I could, Mr. Chair, and to be serious, Chancellor, for a minute.
Go ahead, very humble.
Thank you.
Representative. Okay.
Chancellor Rosenstone, you've been cut, and everybody's been cut, the you know, U of M and you. And, you know, your chart on page 22 that Representative Morrow pointed out, now you've been cut about $2,100, $2,200, and you're getting still a little over $2,600. At what point do the cuts actually completely jeopardize the entire Minsky system? Is that point far off?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornis, Representative Rukavina, we are at that point as we speak. I can ask each of the presidents to come back and share the details on their campuses, but I have seen them. The advising and student support staff, the equipment budgets, the ability to renovate our facilities, the ability to replace equipment to keep it modern, the ability to innovate in the classroom, the ability to, at a moment in time when we need to be serving more students better than ever before, to have fewer resources than ever before to do it, we are at that point. In many of our colleges and universities, we've long gone past the fat, we've long gone past the muscle, we are deep into bone at this point. We are committed to working with this legislature and with the governor and with business and industry and with K-12 to figure out how we're going to solve this problem. But we cannot walk away from this problem and imagine that the prosperity we have in mind and we dream about for our state is going to exist if we're not equipped to deliver the workforce Minnesota needs. So I think it's going to keep all of us at the table, and all of us have to be at the table if we're going to get this job done. But we are not at the point where there's another $20 million we can take out of this system, let alone another $60 million we can take out of this system, and imagine that we're going to deliver on the commitments we're trying to make to the people of Minnesota. That day is here. It's not in the future. It's here.
Any other questions? Otherwise, Chancellor, do you have a kind of a just summary of where we're at?
Just a final final note, though I gave the benediction already. It's been a pretty exciting 6.5 months. We're moving very aggressively. We're not being bashful about the problems we need to take on. We're not just thinking about how we, you know, manage within Minsky. We're trying to think how we put the bigger pieces together to solve some of the problems that the state's facing. We have a very clear understanding of who we're serving. We're serving students. We're serving communities around the state. We're serving businesses around the state. We're trying to serve Minnesota. And we're very clear that we're going to have to do a lot of things differently if we're going to get that job done. And I think you've heard that from each of our presidents. It's also about empowering the presidents. It's trusting the presidents, trusting the faculty, trusting the staff that exist around the system to be the creative ones coming up the ideas. It's not about building a bigger system office. It's about making sure that the system office is there to serve the faculty and staff that are making the job happen on each of our campuses. This is going to continue to be a period of great creativity. We're going to have to make up a lot of new ways of doing things, and we're not afraid to think in new ways. And it's also a period that's going to require a lot of courage. And trust me, some of the things we're talking about are going to require a lot of courage to get them done and to deliver it. We're making tough choices. We're thinking in new ways. We're going to deliver on these three commitments. We are committed to delivering on these three commitments. The board is going to hold us accountable to deliver on these three commitments. And these are the three commitments which are the value proposition for why investing in Minsky is a good payoff for the people of Minnesota. So we really do have the rest of our time for a conversation, Chair Nornes, and I welcome the discussion.
Thank you very much. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, can you go back to slide 27, please? I'm not sure you finished that slide, but I want to go down to bullet point 3.
Good question.
Focused role of system office on serving the colleges and universities. Can you explain that bullet point? Does that come from your conversations around the state where the system office wasn't serving the colleges and universities?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pulaski, yes. I spent many, many months between February when I was appointed and August when I began the job on the road. I met with every president. In many cases, I met with the president's cabinet, meaning the people doing HR, the people doing finance, the people doing facilities, the people doing the academic program, and I did a lot of listening. And what I heard, quite frankly, was that everything happening in the system office was not perceived as value added. Sometimes it was another layer of administration that just was not contributing. I also, of course, read, as undoubtedly this committee did, the legislative auditor's report from a couple years ago. And there's a pretty good lineup between some of the observations the legislative auditor was making and some of the observations I was hearing from presidents across our system and from their leadership teams. I think I came on pretty strong the first couple weeks, which was the purpose of the system office is to serve the colleges and universities and help them get the job done. It's not to create our own set of rules just for the sake of rules. We have laws that we must respect. We have board policy we must respect. We have standards that various federal agencies set that we must respect, and I'm not suggesting we run roughshod over that. But at the end of the day, I want to hear from the presidents and hear from their leadership teams that what we're doing in the system office is helping them get the job done. There has been a realignment, and the cuts we've made were made to protect those things which we hear from the presidents are value-added and to make the things that are not value-added go away. And I think it is, to use the words of one of our presidents, it's a new world. And that is the way we're going to work going forward as long as I'm chancellor.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I appreciate that. You just testified before this committee, following Representative Rukavina's question, that Minsky was at the breaking point. This is in stark contrast to the testimony of your predecessor in May of last year when he testified that the system office could absorb the budget that was being proposed, which was the largest cut to higher education in the history of the state. So my question to you is, are we going to hear from you that if there are future cuts, you can absorb it? Or are we going to hear something different from you?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pulaski, I will tell this committee the truth all the time about the consequences of the choices that are being considered. And if they are painful consequences for our students, if they're painful consequences for our ability to serve Minnesota, if they're painful consequences for our business partners or for communities around the state, I will share those consequences. At the end of the day, we will have to work with the hand that's been dealt. But I will not be bashful about sharing you the consequences of the alternatives you are considering.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I would suggest that your hand may be different if you tell us something different when we present options to higher education. And if higher education says they can absorb it, that isn't saying what you just said, that you're at the breaking point. I noticed that in some of your slides, curiously, the last couple of years are missing, particularly what's happened in this last year, and it may be that you just haven't had time to absorb it. Now, at what point will we see a detailed analysis of what's happened as a result of the budget that was passed by this legislature in 2011 on the Minsky system? And I would hope, instead of having just three or four, and that we have repetitive presidents who seem to come up here a lot, that we would have a systematic look at the cuts programmatically across the 2-year and the 4-year, and what that means for class size, what that means for programs that were eliminated or reduced. I would hope we would have that presentation. If you recall, when you were in Winona, I think it was August 13th on a Friday from 11 to 1, we had a discussion without lunch or even water
about to save some money.
What you would do when you were done with your tour. And I'd hope that we would have an analysis now of, you said courage. I hope you have the courage to present what this budget did across this system. All of these things are nice. I mean, they are commendable to a point. But so is the analysis of this budget. So I know you can't do it now, and I'm not asking for it now. But I would hope the next time we see you, that's what we'll get.
Chancellor Rosenstone, do you have a response?
Look, Chair Norris, I am available to this committee as it requests. I will be happy to provide whatever information the committee requests in the future.
Any other questions from members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chancellor. I do appreciate your forthrightness and ability to bring this together, because we have had in the past the Chancellor who provided lots of fluff and little substance, and I appreciate that you're providing more substance. A couple of things I just want to note. One is that you refer to the system office as the system office, not the office of the Chancellor, and I think that that's an important distinction that has been made, and I certainly appreciate the fact that that's what it's now being referred to as, and it seems like that's a better alignment and a better delineation of what actually it does. I appreciated that the president from Moorhead talked about the new day here and the fact that the presidents are empowered. I believe, again, that is, by their own testimony, I think they're indicating that was not the case. And and I'll be forthright myself, I'm a Minsky employee, and I would say that in the past, I believe that there was much more of a top-down kind of process, and it appears as though it's much more of an inclusive process as you're going forward. And so, you know, I'll give you the opportunity to speak on these things as I conclude here. But the other thing that I just wanted to talk about was teacher preparation. There's a lot of discussion right now about teachers, whether or not they're prepared or not, whether or not they're doing the job that they need to be doing, how we evaluate them, how we train them, how we ascertain whether or not they're doing the work they need to be doing. And I'd like some feedback from you, I guess, regarding teacher preparation with regards to Minsky universities and what you're going to be proposing or what you're looking at with regards to that and the outcome for that. Thank you.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Norris, Representative Poppy, thank you for those comments and questions. The system office helps clarify that this is an office to serve the system, not an office to serve me. There is an office of the Chancellor. It is me, my chief of staff, and two pretty remarkable support people. It is an office of four people, including myself. The rest is the system. The office of the Chancellor is Steve and three other people. There's two ways to think about large, complicated organizations and how you help facilitate change. One is the old command and control model, where you get a very big stick and you wave it as hard as you can, and you try to drive people to do what it is you want. And that just doesn't work. And I have my favorite quotation about that way of managing things comes from one of the principals in a big international design firm in California called IDEO. And the quote is that if central decision-making were as powerful as everybody thought it was, and Silicon Valley would have been located a whole lot closer to Moscow than San Francisco. And I really believe that the very best ideas for how it is we move forward as a system is going to come from empowering the people of the system, our faculty and our staff, with input from our students, with input from our community partners around the state, it's not going to come from more power and more lightning bolts coming out of the Wells Fargo building. It's going to come from empowering people and letting them build the system, hence the philosophy behind the shared service co-op, that you buy in, you reap all the benefits, all the savings ends up on your campuses, and you help design what the shared service is going to look like going forward. That's going to be a far more successful strategy than Steve trying to build it, own it, run it. I'm not smart enough to make all those decisions. I believe our faculty and staff around the system are smart enough to make the right decisions. It'll produce better results. It'll be more stable results. People will own the results. And we can get out of this battle between the system office and our colleges and universities. We'll keep our focus in helping facilitate that work, but the presidents will own it. With respect to teacher preparation, I believe, as President Smetansky mentioned, we're in a very deep partnership here with the Bush Foundation on teacher preparation. It's a partnership that involves St. Cloud, Mankato, Moorhead, and Winona. We're leading the innovations in teacher preparation, not just in the state, but in the nation. Part of it is a deeper engagement of teachers in their preparation in the setting of teaching itself, so that student teachers are getting in longer and earlier into the classroom, where they're having mentors to do a better job of preparing them. Part of it is finding the best practices that exist across our system, and having the faculty and academic leadership of those colleges of education talking to each other and collaborating in a way that we're not only sharing best practices, but we're measuring carefully the outcomes of those practices to know which ones we really ought to scale up. Not everything has to be reinvented on each individual campus. We can learn from each other. That's an essential part of the model that involves other colleges of education beyond just those in Minsku. And the final part of the model of this partnership with Bush is an accountability on what it is we're actually delivering from our programs, with promises being made to school districts that if you partner with us in these new ways, we will guarantee a certain result in the quality of teachers that we're turning out. I think we're at the beginning of year three of this program, so we don't have students that are fully through the pipeline yet. But the response that we're getting from the school districts that have partnered with us have been absolutely remarkable, and people are very excited about it. I believe what we're doing in Minnesota will become the national model. But I think the underlying assumption of your question is exactly right, that if we don't have remarkable teachers in the classroom, we're not going to get remarkable graduates coming to our colleges and universities. And the faculty in our colleges of education in those universities I mentioned are trying to lead the change to produce remarkable teachers.
Members. Okay, go ahead.
May I just have one follow-up on that? With regards to those four universities, do you have teacher preparation in each of the state universities? Is there a teacher ed, or just in those four universities?
Chancellor?
Well, I wish I could call for a lifeline on this question, Chair Norna. I do not believe. The answer is yes. My lifeline has arrived. The answer is yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I can ask more.
Okay. I was just going to mention to members, we have a couple of students that would like to speak to us before our time runs out, too. So, Mr. Representative Chair. Atkins? Before, is this pertaining to what we're talking about right now, Representative
yes.
Pulaski? Then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, on slide number...
You want to pull your mic down? We'd like to hear
On slide number 9, you have 49% of new teachers, and you have some impressive statistics on other professions that you create the numbers of individuals for. Does this match up with the need in Minnesota? So whatever the 49% of new teachers that are being produced, is that matching up directly because we need that number of teachers, or is it just a nice statistic for this chart?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pulaski, it is indeed a nice statistic for the start, but it also matches up with workforce needs. Part of the whole motivation of the Bush program was that we're about to enter a period of time when a huge cohort of teachers are going to retire. And the question is, how do we meet that retirement that's going to occur? So the impetus for the Bush program was to look very carefully at what that retirement cohort is going to look like and ask the question, are we going to fill it in a far more powerful way than we filled it? And so this is not about expanding the number of teachers. It's making sure we got a good match between the number of graduates we're turning out and the skills they have and the number of needs that are there in the workforce. The broader implication of your question, I think, is a very important one for us to be discussing, and it gets back to this workforce effort that we're engaged in. Part of the motivation this spring for this region-by-region, sector-by-sector mapping of the workforce is not just to listen and make sure we understand the skills, but to go back to all of our colleges and universities and ask the question that you're asking, Representative Pulaski: where do we need to grow programs to meet those needs and match up, and where do we need to shrink programs because the needs are not there? And the only way we can answer that question is to first have really good information about what those needs are. It's more than just data from DEED. It's a nuanced understanding by talking directly with employers. So the hope going forward is we will get that alignment, and the first step to that alignment is lots of listening, and that's what this spring's exercise is about. Next fall, we start the process of the alignment of academic programs to meet the demand.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. I would like at some point someone from your system office to come in and show me that that is indeed the case, that you are producing teachers for jobs that are ready for those teachers. I've taught the teaching social studies in the secondary at Winnow State for 15 years. I've had a steady increase in the number of potential social studies teachers. I have a fairly good idea where they ended up, and I would say that that is not the case. So I would like someone to show me that this number is indeed a match to the number of teachers you're going to need, and I would like to know the year you're going to need them. Is it next year or a decade from now?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer my time to hear from the students. Just one request for the Chancellor.
Yes.
Thank you, by the way, for taking the job. We're very excited to have you. I would, just on a page or two, like to see the impact of the cuts. I don't know if you have a master sheet that demonstrates that, but you talked about the dire straits that we're now in. And I've never seen anything from the system talking about what the impact of the cuts has actually amounted to. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd love to turn my time over to the students.
All right. And Representative Rukavina, you're going to do the same?
Well, just quickly, though, I do want to thank you, Chancellor, for your candor, and I think you've come into this job with a really open mind and an open ear, too. One of the things you touched on was the dependence on faculty and staff for input, and for 4 years that I chaired this committee, I tried to put some of the people in the trenches on the Board of Trustees. I know it's not your point or your job to, you know, address that, but I'm hoping that as positions open up and you're talking to the governor, that you think about those faculty and staff people in your system that might be a valuable asset to being on that Board of Trustees.
Well, in wrapping up, we want to thank you, Chancellor, for being here. We do have to have a little time for the students and also the interfaculty organization would like to speak to us, too. So we'll see you later some later future date. You're always welcome back.
Thank you very much, Chair Nornes. Yeah. Thank you, members of the committee. Terrific discussion. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chancellor Rosenstone. Now we have the students. If you can keep your comments as brief as possible. And I'm sure you will be brief.
Yes, we will.
Begin by identifying each of
Chair Nornes, committee members, thank you so much. Excuse my voice today. For the record, I'm Amanda Bardonner, State Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Obviously here today in support of the new strategic framework that the Chancellor has just laid out for you. Just wanted to briefly talk on my experience with the partnerships that our universities have with community businesses, the impact that it has had on my internship and then my future career search. I've had the experience of working with my international marketing class last semester, actually. We partnered with the St. Cloud Area Ventilation Company, Schaefer Ventilation, actually in Sauk Rapids, to develop an international entrance strategy for several Latin American countries. We determined what Schaefer would need to bring their products to these locations in the global marketplace and evaluated any risks that they would have associated with that. I had the opportunity then this summer to travel to Brazil and was able to use the knowledge I acquired in my course to identify potential competitors for Schaefer Ventilation. This experience made me aware of the challenges and opportunities that U.S. companies face abroad, and it also is these types of learning experiences that prepared myself and students across the systems to succeed in an ever-changing global economy. The strategic framework recognizes the changing face of education and our workplace. It used to be that students would seek internships to gain experiences needed for their careers. Now, increasingly, competitive internships require experience. It is up to the universities to create an educational experience that prepares students like myself for internships and our future jobs. My experience in class and travel to Brazil gave me the actual practical skills that employers value. In fact, a student in my class was hired by Schaefer Ventilation as a summer intern to implement the strategy our group developed for entrance into Peru and continues there on a part-time basis while in school. The strategic framework has a strong commitment to making higher education affordable and accessible, something that is at the core value of our association. We know that Minnesota needs an educated workforce, and we believe that Minsky's strategic framework will help achieve that objective. The changing demographics in our state and an increasing dependence on student loans make it even more important for our state to make college affordability a priority. We believe that there is a commitment within this framework to ensure that Minnesota families can afford the public higher education. We look forward to working with the system and continuing conversations. I'll yield my time to Jeff Dittmer.
Thank you, Amanda.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jeff Dittmer, president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. It's my pleasure to testify on behalf of the two-year community and technical college students in support of the Chancellor and the Board of Trustees strategic framework. These goals include bold initiatives for Minsky that show great promise for moving the system in a direction to even better serve the students of our two-year colleges. Chancellor Rosenstone has made it clear that these changes will need input from all stakeholders, especially students. Of particular interest to students are plans to continue to improve credit transfer experiences and discussions about revamping online education. In regards to the tuition, the Chancellor has said that he has heard us on tuition and he gets it. In this framework, the Minsky system commits to offering the highest value and most affordable option. This vision can help us move our two-year colleges away from the charging the third highest tuition and fees in our country. We look forward to being part of ongoing conversations during the implementation of this framework and share our optimism in what we can achieve by working together to make these goals a reality. With that, I thank you again for the opportunity, and we will stand for any questions.
Thank you both for your testimony today. And any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
When you told the said the Chancellor heard you on tuition and he gets it, does that mean he gets the tuition or he gets it? He shouldn't raise it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that was our first question for him.
Thank you very much for
being here. Thank you.
And we have one more testifier or two. And we have about 5 minutes.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Nornes and representatives. And I'm Donald F. Larson. I'm a professor of English at Minnesota State University, Mankato, but I'm here today in my capacity as the president of the interfaculty organization, the IFO, which represents the faculty at the 7 state universities of the Minsky system. With me today is my colleague, Professor Monty Butte from Metropolitan State University. I'll let him introduce himself.
Monty Butte, Metro State, and I'm the IFO Action Coordinator.
And those who might know me will know this is a struggle, but I will keep my comments brief. I want to make 5 major points. First, that the IFO agrees with the 3 goals of the strategic framework that you see behind me that the Chancellor has described. Who could not possibly agree with those goals? How we lay them out, how we define them, how we use them in our state universities, in our work, in our classes, with our students, these are the key questions that we're going to be working with and are working with the Chancellor, with our university presidents, with our university administrations, and our colleagues at the state universities. The IFO's mission includes the words that our mission is to improve higher education, and that we do so through the shared governance processes that we have with the system office and with our 7 state universities. I want to highlight briefly 2 points from the Chancellor's presentation on slides 19 and 20 when he discusses what the workforce of the future will require. when you look at the outcomes, the skills that are listed there, communication skills, intellectual agility, ability to adapt and apply knowledge to new programs and so forth, these are certainly the hallmarks of our professional programs, such as nursing, law enforcement, engineering, and so on, but just as much, if not more so, for our many liberal arts programs, including political science, but also English, my own discipline, philosophy, and many others, that taken together, carefully planned, put in context and combined with other skills, prepare our students not just to meet the job demands of 2012 when they graduate, but also how they'll need to be able to redefine themselves in their work, in their lives as citizens, and in their lives with their families in 2022, 2032, and beyond. When you look at slide 20, the fact that 70% of Minnesota's jobs will require some post-secondary education, as many of you know, that statistic comes out of a study by Georgetown University, which stated that that put Minnesota in the third highest position for the need for some form of higher education. What's less often cited about that same study is that it also concluded we would be the fifth highest state in the nation in the need for baccalaureate or higher education degrees, a fact that is not at all at odds with the other statistics the Chancellor has provided here. Taken together, what it's saying is Minnesota is in extreme need for all forms of higher education. Associate degrees and bachelor degrees, certificate programs and graduate programs. But we need all these things at a time when our legs are being cut out from under us and the cost of higher education is being shifted to the shoulders of our students. So I'll just conclude by stating again, the IFO is not only standing ready, but already has been actively engaged for a couple of years before the Chancellor came aboard in trying to work with the system office and our state universities to advance our mutual goals for the good of our students and for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Being 10 months past my expiration date, I'm just glad to be here with all my friends again.
We're happy
to see you.
I would like to raise three cautionary notes for you to keep in mind. The first is a question. Is Minscu becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce? I have my concerns about this. Now, I am. There's probably no more greater proponent of teaching and learning and helping students get lifelong skills. But you know, those business organizations who so badly want an educated workforce want it free. Those same business organizations for the past decades have demanded cut after cut and have refused to raise the taxes necessary. I ask you to put more pressure on the business community to begin paying for what they're getting from us. We, as the Chancellor said, have hit the wall. No more blood can come out of this turnip. I think you'd also be surprised, some of you that are such great advocates of workforce development, this is essentially a Scandinavian industrial policy and all the implications thereof. The second cautionary notes is I think we need to carefully beware that what we're doing with Minscu is not so skewed to the needs of business that we are turning our students into widgets that we're manufacturing for those businesses. Students are not commodities for employers. Students should always be ends in themselves, and the value of students should stand above any workforce needs. Now, I want them to get jobs. I want this to be a good partnership, but let's keep a balance. Remember, you could speak a little more strongly about students being widgets back in the day when the state paid 80% of my tuition. The students are paying the freight now. And the last cautionary note that I would like to raise is too much of the talk about technology and technological skills is short-sighted. It is education for the short term. And I'd like to just, in closing, read a quote from the novelist Doris Lessing. All the pressures go the other way, towards learning only what is immediately useful, what is functional. More and more, the demand is for people to be educated to function in an almost certainly temporary stage of technology. Education for the short term. We have to look at the word useful again. In the long run, what is useful is what survives, revives, and comes to life in different contexts. My life has been an example of someone who, because they were given a liberal arts education and I was well schooled in the intellectual virtues that many businesses seek, I have been able to switch careers 5 or 6 times. Without that broad background that many employers want of the ability to have teamwork, to think analytically, to create oral and written communication that's first rate, we're failing students in this process. So I will close with that.
Okay, I appreciate that very much, because we are out of time. And one quick comment from Representative Morrill.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're...
seniority.
I didn't see you down there.
Mr. Chair, you and I are going to a dinner on the Midwest Higher Education Compact next week. I just wanted to encourage Minsky, as they're talking about shared services, to maximize the investment the state's making in that
absolutely,
compact.
Absolutely. Representative Roccovino.
Mr. Chair, and to both of you, and Monty, especially you, you know, you've been around a long time. You're looking great, by the way. And I know, just like you, I couldn't hold a job either, so I had to keep changing. But be honest with us. Were the cuts through all the collaboration in the Minsky system, were they taken harder by admin, support staff, faculty, or students? Who carried the most load, according to what you two think?
If I keep it very, very brief, we're over time. We need to adjourn.
A quick answer. I think in the long run, any cuts ultimately affect the student most, whether it's directly or indirectly. We've lost faculty positions. We still have faculty, tenured faculty, who are due to be laid off at the end of this year. There have been system cuts in administration, and we are missing some of the people who were genuinely helpful to us and did important work for us. But in the long run, again, it's what the students get from us, from our system, from our administration that matters. They're the ones who bear the brunt. Yeah.
I want to thank everyone that testified today and for the members staying with us, and we are now adjourned.
Thank you for the time.
Answer it correctly.